Thanks for joining me this week. This is a little different this week. I'm going to actually have, I was a guest on David Twitchell's show. Actually, we recorded this a while back, but just recently I was a guest on his internet show and his radio show out of the Detroit area, which is on public broadcasting. And it was kind of nice because we got to talk and he got to ask me questions. I still found a way to ask him some questions, but David's been on the program before. We talk about UFOs. We talk about the people that have been on my show. So those of you that haven't listened to all the different shows, I'm going to feature some of that. So this is an interview that is hosted by a man by the name of David Twitchell, who I've gotten to know over a period of time now, who I really click with. He's really, to me, he's like a good friend that I've never met. And he has a program that's called We Are Not Alone.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And I want to welcome our new Tuesday listeners. We are now moving. We used to be on Saturdays at 10 o'clock. Forget that. We've moved to Tuesdays at 1 p.m., and so, for those of you who were expecting to hear music in this time slot, well, surprise. But stick around anyway, because we're going to hear something just as interesting. And for those of our loyal listeners who are on Saturdays, welcome to the Tuesday slots. And don't forget, you can always listen on the archives by going to the forum button on WHFR's homepage. And listen to all the forum shows. And today we're going to turn the tables on and interview the interviewer. T.J. Ryan is the host of the radio show Out There. It's a podcast radio show that deals with the paranormal in general, to include the UFO phenomenon. T.J. lives in the cold sanctity of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, where sky watching can become a favorite pastime of many of its residents. But he interviews authorities from all over the country. And TJ has had me on his show a couple of times. And he's just a delightful personality to have a conversation with. So I thought I'd return the favor and pick his brain for an hour. So welcome to We Are Not Alone, TJ.
Thank you very much, David, for having me on your show. This is awesome.
I'm really happy to have you on. We always have a good time every time we're on your show. You always trick me into saying something that I don't think I'm being recorded, and then it plays on the show.
I like to throw that on right at the end after the show's over, kind of like the Ferris Bueller movie where you think the movie's over, but
right,
there's still more going on.
Right, right, right. More like the outtakes, right?
Yeah, nothing too bad, but just the real side of who we are. And
right.
I do that because I want people to realize we're not staging anything, just like you do with your show.
Right.
I'm sure there are some programs out there that might do some of that.
Right. No, that's not good. I mean, you know,
right.
if you know it's a stage show, you know it's a fictional show, you know it's all scripted. That's one thing, but to pretend like it's impromptu, and when you're all reading the script, I couldn't do that. I think the listeners know when I'm reading the script or not.
Well, even like the reality ones, I just talked to a fellow who's going to be on my show this week, and he has some kind of new, you know, they have the Monster Quest and UFO Hunters and all those programs mm-hmm. on History Channel.
Right.
I think they got a new one coming out, but it's, you know, it's supposed to be reality-based. He told me that when he was on this show, they would have him do more than one take. Now, it was something he said that it was accurate, but they wanted to change it because they wanted the inflection to be different. So to me, even when you do that a little bit, it's not an actual, you know, it's still the truth, but it's kind of tainted a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. That is scripting it, isn't it?
A little bit. They want to have the effect, and I suppose they have to do that for TV, but we don't have to do that.
Have to do that. No, this is a very honest, as far as we know, show. You know, everything we say is honest, I believe. At least as we believe the truth to be.
Now, has anybody ever interviewed you on your show?
Has anyone ever interviewed me? You know, I had James Fox on that did the Out of the Blue, producer of Out of the Blue, and mm-hmm. I Know What I Saw, and I got to get him back. Anyway, he turned the tables on me, and I mentioned my UFO sighting in 62, and he said, oh, tell me about that. So I started telling, and I said, now he's interviewing me on my show. Oh, well. But anyway, your show. Let's talk about your show, Out There.
Okay.
Among other topics, you address the UFO phenomenon. And how did you become interested in the UFO phenomenon in the first place?
I guess I grew up with a very open-minded mother who was discussing many things. But my first incident was when I was in the third grade. I don't know what age that is, 8, 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be looking out my bedroom window on the second story, and it overlooked the first story of the kitchen. So I could see over the top of the kitchen roof, and I was looking eastward at the time. And my parents were outside in the yard. It was a summer night, and they were looking at the stars. And I would always peek out my window and look at them as well, hoping to see something, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this thing on the horizon, pretty good size, because the horizon was quite a ways away, over the trees, looked oval in shape, and it had several different colors going around it. And I thought, well, I guess it could be a plane, but I never saw a plane with that many colors. It was at least 3 or 4 different colors on it.
Hmm.
Red, for sure, was one of them. And I watched this thing as it just floated over the horizon, going from north to south. And my parents watched it as well, and they didn't say much about it or anything. And my mom shouted out, well, I think I know what it is. And she never told me. So I don't know if she was trying to calm me, but I wasn't afraid. I just thought, this is really cool. What if this is something more? Now, to this day, I don't really know what it is, but it got me interested in more deeply in searching for, you know, what the answer might be.
Right.
And then my own personal experience, and you and I talked about this before, and you say it's kind of a gray area, because was it a visitation or was it something I was dreaming?
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, I believe it was, I had read in a book somewhere, and I don't know if it was Whitley Strieber's communion book, about how he had been visited and taken more than once, several times.
Right.
He almost seemed to, as I recall, and it's been a while since I read that book, he seemed to form some kind of connection with these beings. Do you recall that at all, David?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And he had,
in communion, his book Communion.
And it's almost like he had a telepathic connection with them. He could think about them, and that's what I felt too. And so I read somewhere in a book that if you, and maybe this sounds a little bizarre, you meditate and kind of think about something as you're relaxing and falling asleep, they may come visit. And so that's what I did one night. I don't know why I chose to do this, but this was at my mom's house again. I live in Escanaba, but I traveled to Norway, which is about 50 miles away, and I spent the night at my mom's. So I was thinking about this going to bed, and I didn't even tell my mom. We always talked about this kind of stuff, but I didn't tell her. And I fell asleep, and I don't know what time it is. It's like 1 o'clock maybe in the morning. I wake up, and something woke me up. And I look around the room, and I don't see anything at first. And then I notice to the left side of the bed, there's this small figure. And it becomes more clear that it's what one would describe as a gray. It's maybe 4 feet tall. It's got big eyes, frail-looking body. And I watched it kind of just glide over to the right side of the bed and get closer to me. And I was looking at it, and I'm thinking, God, I hope you don't get any closer than that. And at that moment, I could not move. And I started to panic. I could not move any part of my body. The only thing I could move was my eyes. I couldn't move my head. I couldn't move my neck. I couldn't move my chest, my arms, nothing. I was breathing. It was difficult to even breathe. And I do remember reading something about, and again, I don't know if this is Whitley or others that have talked about this, that they seem to put you in some kind of state where you cannot move.
Right.
You've heard that before.
Yes, I have. Yeah.
And at that moment, a thought hit me, and I don't know where it came from. I could make a guess maybe where it came from. And the thought was, if you have no intention of hurting this thing, it might loosen things up on you. It might loosen the reins a little bit. It might loosen control. And when I hit that thought and I focused on it, I thought, well, I don't want to hurt him. I just wanted to see him, see if he's real, you know? And all of a sudden, I could start turning my head a little bit. And then I felt my arms loosening up and my chest got easier and I could breathe a little easier. And that was it. And I was out like a light. And I don't recall anything till I woke up the next morning, which might have been 9 or 10 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, I thought, well, maybe it's just a dream. But my experience with most dreams, pretty much all dreams, if you don't wake up right after that dream, you're not going to remember it. And this was very vivid. I mean, it was, you kind of think you know the difference between life and a dream.
All right.
Now, granted, it could have been a dream, but most of me believes it wasn't. Most of me believes that because I desired this contact, this thing showed up in my room.
Right. Well, you know, last month we were speaking with Peter Robbins on the show, and we were talking about this sleep paralysis and this idea of sleep paralysis, which is a legitimate physical condition, sleep paralysis, where you're half awake, half asleep, you can't move. You move your eyes, and typically what you're speaking of here. But at the same time, I'm not saying that that's what it was in your case. We were also talking about the fact that how many people, even under sleep paralysis, they feel like they're floating out of their, floating up in the air, or maybe out of their body, because they're paralyzed. They can't feel the bed beneath them. But they don't typically have this see these little gray beings in their room, and they don't typically have the same. I think if it is sleep paralysis, if the whole alien abduction phenomenon is sleep paralysis, then I think it really needs some scientific investigation, because it is a phenomenon in that everyone who is having these sleep paralysis episodes is having the same dream.
Right.
Being floated out of the window, being floated through the walls, going up to the craft, seeing the same beings, being on a table, being examined, and on and on and on.
And a lot of it's blamed on, from what I know, what we've seen or heard on television. And the thing is, back in the late 80s, there wasn't a lot of that being shown.
Right.
So people that were talking about that back then, I feel, were probably more legitimate about it because they were the pioneers. They were the first ones coming forward.
Right.
So this is 92. Granted, I had read Communion, so some could say that was in my dream. But I'll tell you, I know the difference between a dream and sitting up and being awake and being scared. You feel the emotion.
Right.
I mean, certainly there is a possibility. I don't want to rule anything out. But as far as I'm concerned, somebody came for a visit.
Yeah. Was that the only experience you had like that?
That is the only experience that I desired to have. I really haven't tried to focus on that.
Okay.
Since then. I mean, I've had some dreams about, I know they're dreams about UFOs landing or chasing me. But I know the difference between something that is a dream. At least I think I do.
right.
But, you know, several people in my family have had experiences as well. I mean, this just all continues to add to a person starting to, you know, really accept that this is certainly possible. My own son, when he was a young, they were camping, he was pretty young at the time, maybe 10, 11 years old. Him and another kid, you know, and I feel they're pretty credible, that they're my family.
Right.
So he saw something flying over them, and it split in two. And that's pretty much the end of it. My wife has seen, when she was traveling with another gal, something in the sky that was dancing around and it was following them.
Mm-hmm.
My mother-in-law, who I really can't get much out of her because she's kind of afraid to speak about it, she, years ago, and I believe her sister was with her at the time, they saw something land, a metallic, disc-like ship or object land. I tried to get the some research as how big this was. She says it wasn't real huge. But when she came back and told her husband, they pretty much ridiculed her and made fun of her. So she kind of vowed to never really talk about it. And you wonder how many people have lived that way, you know?
Oh, many, many people. You know, they say that 11% of sightings that are reported sightings, and there are like 10,000 of them a year around the world, that represents 11% of the actual sightings, because people are afraid to tell anyone for fear of ridicule.
Yes, and there are so many people. There's a good friend of mine who I work with at the radio station. Mm-hmm. He still hasn't come on my show because I think he's afraid of the ridicule. But he has a really amazing story. When he was about 18, this was probably about 1980. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a bunch of small towns in Upper Michigan.
Right.
And he was traveling from a town called Trenary to another one called Munising. And that was kind of in a northeast direction on a really lonely stretch of road. It's about maybe 30 miles of road where there's really nothing. And he was somewhere on that road when he looked in his rearview mirror and saw a light, a single light. And he thought it was a headlight, you know, just a car with one headlight.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't think much of it. Car was coming the opposite way on the highway, and when it's get close enough to him, this single light behind him moved, and he watched it in his mirror and then looked out his window, and he saw it go behind trees. And when the car passed, this thing came back behind him again, and then another car came and it went behind the trees again. And so again, what would that be? You know, is the government following him? I mean, he's a 18-year-old guy at the time and was working in radio like he is now. I don't think they were worried too much about him back then. And if it's a helicopter, he said there was no sound for that. So this other car goes by, the thing gets behind him again, he just floored it. He says, I got out of there, I wasn't going to stick around. And I said, well, Joe, why don't you get out and take a look? He goes, maybe if somebody else would have been with me, I would have done that. But when you're by yourself, I think people... I probably would be frightened. Wouldn't you be frightened, David, if something came up behind you like that?
Definitely. Especially looking in the mirror. In a mirror. You know, I watched the movie the other, what was it, Hunting in Connecticut. They love to do the thing with the mirrors. And that just makes the hair on my all over stand up. When you look in a mirror and you see something gruesome behind you, because you feel so defenseless. You've got your back to it, and you know it's there.
And you know that it's whatever it was that was behind him was intelligent, because it was getting out of the way so it wouldn't be seen by others. And but furthermore, it asked the question, why was it following him?
But it went off into the trees. I mean, he saw it on the road behind him, right?
He saw it on the road behind him, just the light of it, just the one light, and it disappeared over the trees.
Well, what kind of vehicle would go into the trees from the road, you know?
Exactly. And again, the technology in 1980... Maybe the government has more things than we're aware of, and maybe they were doing some experimenting. I mean, there is possible answers for it, too, but that, to me, is very mysterious.
You know, I think the government, I know the government's got a lot more technologies than they're letting on to us. That said, I think we give too much credit to the government, to our government, to the governments of the world, because we're saying, you know, oh boy, isn't that wonderful? We get, it's got to be human technology because nobody's smarter than us.
Right.
Excuse me, you know, I hope that this isn't the best that God can do, you know?
If it is, the universe might be in some trouble.
Oh, it's in trouble.
We may destroy ourselves before we move further along.
I have to stop for just a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone on our new time slot here on Tuesday at 1 p.m. And we're speaking with the host of Out There, Out There, Out There, Out There. how'd you like that, TJ?
That's good. I should have you do the opens for me.
Yeah, his radio show is Out There, and this is TJ Ryan.
And I was just going to say, David, I've been in broadcasting for over 30 years.
Uh-huh.
I've been up here for over 20 years at the same radio group of stations. I started out there in the spring of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming up on 2 years of doing the show. I presented it to management, and they kind of gave me a weird look. And so I thought the only route I can go probably is on the Internet with a podcast. And like you say, we do a lot of shows. I do a lot of shows about just about anything I find curious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Can be just about anything. And sometimes they're just positive, upbeat shows that make you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's not enough of that, too, going on.
We know.
Go ahead, David.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is public radio. And, you know, we're talking about commercial radio, right?
Right.
You're on commercial radio.
That's correct.
And, you know, we'd make a good team. You've got the voice for radio. I've got the face for radio. But anyway.
We could be like a tag team.
We could.
I let you go in for a while and soften them up, wrestle them a bit. And then I'll go in for the pin.
Good.
Or vice versa.
Sounds great. But anyway. Jay Kornick here at WHFR had me on his show talking about my my book, The UFO Jesus Connection. And he has a talk show, the WHFR Journal. Anyway, he was interviewing me, and when I was done, I do a TV show for on Comcast Cable. And I'd done that for 7 years at the time. So I said to him, after he interviewed me, what do you think they'd say to a show like mine on radio? And expecting, you know, the same response you've gotten. And he says, oh, I think that would work. Next thing you know, I'm taking the course, I'm here on the radio, and
wow,
the rest is history. So maybe public radio.
Yeah, well, maybe just the right place at the right time with the right management
That's it.
You know, for one, it does draw a lot of people, I would imagine. People are interested in this. Mm. They love the unknown. Mm. We want to find out. We're curious. That's what I think a lot of people are drawn, whether it's paranormal or, you know, UFOs.
Right.
And again, there are so many people that have seen things. I think that if you look through enough of a family, now maybe not just like a four-person family, but within the whole group of relatives, somebody has some kind of experience they can tell you that's kind of bizarre.
Oh, listen, I'll tell you. You know, my sister was afraid to tell people at a church about her our sighting back in 62. And I told her, I said, you know, you tell 10 people. Don't tell them together, because they all have to bond together and say, ha-ha, or, you know, ridicule it. But take them separately and tell 10 different people. 4 out of 5 of them are going to have a story for you.
Right.
And so she took me up on that challenge, and she found that was true. You know, most of them will say, well, you know, I never told anybody this, but now that you bring it up,
yep.
Or I know somebody who has had this experience, they'll always have a story for you.
That's exactly the way I did it, too. Mm. I would endear people by telling them my story, my stories, I should say, because I've had some other paranormal weird things happen.
Mm.
And then they would open up and say, well, you know what, between you and I, okay.
All right.
Never told anybody.
Right.
And then my way of kind of finding out if it was a valid story is I would quiz them on them every so often. And if the story didn't change, and if I didn't feel they were doing it to gain anything other than just to tell me what was in their heart. You
don't mess with you, right?
You know, if they were doing it to get publicity, that's one thing. But if they're doing it to just share something with you, again, anybody can lie to anybody.
Right.
You know, I guess somewhere along the way, you have to take a leap of faith.
Right.
There's a good friend of mine who has been on my program, and I believe we talked about UFOs. There was an incident involving the police up here, and that was back in the 80s in Marquette, the city of Marquette, which is the biggest town in Upper Michigan on Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 70 miles maybe from where I live, and I go up there often, quite often. But back then, and this might have even been in the 70s as I recall the story, but he was near the docks, and not only did he witness the six craft, diamond-shaped craft. The police were there. The people working on the docks were afraid. They just took off running, and they watched these things hover over through the clouds and then eventually disappear. And they slowly moved out of the area. And several eyewitnesses, and again, when you have a police sergeant at the time, he eventually went on to become police chief, that sees something, you know, they don't normally want to stick their neck out online, but he did file a report on it.
All right.
So, again, here's another person I get to know, and he just starts telling me stuff. Well, another individual who I do not want to release his name because he was in the military, and I don't know if he's worried about repercussions with that. So we'll just call him Deep Throat. And no, we won't call him that. That name was taken already.
Yeah, I think it's name. Okay, go ahead.
And so, but he was stationed in Greenland. There's a base, isn't there? Like,
oh,
Greenland,
yeah.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
And it was like one of the main bases. If we were ever attacked by the Soviets, it would be the first line of defense.
Okay.
And he was telling me more than once he witnessed something come in on radar at 10,000 miles an hour, stop on a dime, and then take off again. Mm-hmm. And he looked to his commanding officer and he says, "Do you want me to make a report on that?" And he said, "You didn't see anything. I didn't see anything, no report."
That's it.
And how many times has that probably happened?
And that's how the secret is being kept in plain sight.
You know, people say, well, if the government knew anything about this, the government would, they talk too much and the word would get out. But there's also, I think, a pile of disinformation going on as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so when some truth does come out, well, it was just weather balloons, and we had some crash test dummies in there. And even though they weren't invented until
right.
2 years from now,
right.
We believe it was just these dummies and some weather balloons. Jesse Marcel, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
And I tend to believe that Jesse was actually telling the truth, especially since his son continues to speak of it as well.
Right. And so, they got promoted from there. All the big bosses got the guy that came out with the... The guy that gave the word to put out the press release that the disc had crashed. He can't tell the difference between a flying saucer and a weather balloon. And you'd think he'd get busted to private or latrine,
right.
Head of latrine, and he gets promoted.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Maybe that's how it works in the military.
Yeah, I think so. Impossible. Yeah.
Promoted. So on my show, over the course of a year and a half, from time to time, you know, it just seems to go in streaks. I like to mix it up a bit, but one of my interesting guests that I really did his homework, and I've told you about him before, you know, you've done a lot of research about UFOs over the years, right, and talked to many, many, many people.
Right.
Did you ever notice that the craft that they spotted back in the 50s and maybe the early 60s was so different in the description as to what we see now?
Pretty much, yeah.
Like pods, almost?
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah, some of them were cigar-shaped and saucer-shaped, but also some of them were like these pods that landed.
Right.
There was that famous incident, where was that, in Arizona, New Mexico?
You're thinking of Socorro, New Mexico, Lonnie Zamora, and the egg-shaped
egg-shaped craft.
Right.
And it wasn't very big. And he came across it, and it took off, right?
Right, right.
Well, there was a man, his name is Frank Ficino. He's out of, I think it's Daytona Beach, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent 18 years of his life. And this was a guest I've had on a couple of times. Did he ever get back with you, by the way, Frank?
I never got with him.
Okay.
Did you notify him?
I did through email, but I'll talk to him again. And maybe you'd be interested to have him on your show.
Sure.
He certainly has done his research. In West Virginia, in 1952, there was an incident that was reported by over 200 people, I believe, are the facts of that. And this was they called it the Flatwoods Monster, because what they saw was this craft, and then they saw something take off from this craft that was apparently, it was either shot down or it had a malfunction, and something took off from it, and it was like riding on this platform. There was a being riding on this platform. And people saw this, and that's where they came up with the name, the Flatwoods Monster. So if you go to flatwoodsmonster.com, you'll be able to take a good look at that picture. It's a little scary looking, but to me, Frank answered a lot of questions as to why these crafts are so different back then, and how come we don't see them now. In his 18 years of research talking to the locals, and it took him a long time to earn trust with them because they had been burned many times, Frank was able to talk to many, many different eyewitnesses that came forward finally and spoke about what they saw, and he was able to piece together how this thing, the flight trajectory, where it came, where you think it got shot down, and then where it took off again, and people that saw it within that radius of maybe 100 miles. And so it came to believe that this was some kind of being that survived the attack on its ship and was trying to make repairs, and I think another craft came along to help it before it eventually got out of there, and people saw all that, and they watched it around, and then Frank wrote another book called Shoot Them Down, and he believes it was a military order. These things had come over in the 50s. They buzzed the White House. There's documentation of that.
Right.
And they went over what appeared to be going towards like installations, airbase installations, and that's when they gave the order, according to Frank, to shoot these things down, and that's when there was this battle that took place, and we didn't hear much about it, and the public still hasn't to this day.
There was actually a battle between we humans and the...
From what I understand.
Is that right?
The jets were scrambled, and I don't know what they were back then. Frank told me, but I don't remember what kind of jets they were.
Okay.
But he also documented, because he wasn't able to get a whole lot of information. Obviously, the government's not going to release that about our pilots. But there was more pilots lost in that time period in the 50s to early 60s. And these were well-trained pilots that had been in Korea than had ever been in the history of our country. And how did they, how did their planes go down?
Throughout the Second World War in Korea?
I mean, well, not during war period, but I
while
these pilots were in our country,
okay,
you know, these were trained pilots, some of them had been in wars before,
right,
and there were more disappearances or crashes, as maybe the military called it, and you just wonder, how can there be so many? And so he kind of puts that together in this book, and he actually talked to the father of a pilot that was told, basically told his son never even existed, never was in the military.
Oh, good Lord.
Before he finally brought out this information, and they admitted, yes, he was. But the father obviously had a very difficult time with that because they wouldn't admit anything. So here's a man I think that spent a good part of his life, certainly did his homework. And I know he's talked with Stanton Friedman a lot about this. He's mentioned that to me more than once. And he's been on different programs as well. So I think he's... his books certainly do validate a lot of what he has to say, because there are many, 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 many witnesses, and some of them are, most of them are just regular folks.
Right.
And some of them are military, and some of them are police. So again, I don't know if that lends any more credibility to you, David. Do you feel that is?
I think it does. I think just like in the abduction phenomenon is cross-section of people. You know, they say, well, why don't they ask to speak to our president? Well, they don't want to speak to presidents. They don't want to speak to world leaders. They want to see a cross-section of the quasi-intelligent beings on this planet. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I believe. So, yes, there should be a cross-section of The average citizen that sees these craft or is abducted. And then you're going to get the police officers, you're going to get military personnel, per capita. In other words, there's not as many police officers as there are civilians. So you're going to get two police officers for every 100 civilians, let's say, that have these sightings or are abducted. But there are police officers and military people there that are abducted that have these sightings from every walk of life.
All right, with that, we're going to wrap up segment one of this two-part interview. And, it's tough doing one full hour. And I give David a lot of credit. That's why I like taking breaks after 10 minutes, because you can refocus your thoughts. 10 minutes is a breeze. Talking for a whole hour, I had to make all these notes. And even then, I'm thinking, boy, I hope I got enough to stretch this out for an hour. Anyway, we'll continue part two next week. Thanks for joining us on Out There.